Is there anything you would have done differently?
We reported a true story.
Our colleague Brian Williams is back in Kuwait City tonight after a close call in the skies over Iraq.
Controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and questions about Kavanaugh's drinking in the past.
Sean Hannity, come on up, Sean Hannity.
Today, Andrew Cuomo is having a moment.
Hi there. I'm Chris Steyerwald.
And I'm Eliana Johnson.
Welcome to Inkstained Wretches, where we break down what's going wrong and what's going right with the American news media. Eliana Johnson, question. On The Hill Sunday with Chris Steyerwald, watch it on your local affiliate or on News Nation at 10 a.m. on Sundays Eastern. We have John Fetterman on this week.
Oh.
What should I ask John Fetterman?
I think you should ask him about whether Joe Biden is taking the right posture toward campus protests.
Mm-hmm.
Should he be more vocal
mm-hmm.
about it? What should he be saying, if anything?
Saying it in a weird, quiet shout. What should Joe Biden be saying in a weird, quiet shout?
Yeah.
I think that's a good question. What are you
inclined to talk to him about?
I frankly just find him fascinating. I find him fascinating. And what I'm really curious to know.
Oh, I got another thought.
Tell me.
Didn't mean to cut you off there.
Not at all.
Was he always pro-Israel, or was it some kind of awakening after October 7th?
Well, this is what I generally want to find out about is, and I'm sure his team is listening to this intently to prepare for the interview, but...
His team? Hey, Senator, I'm sure you're out there listening.
Who, obviously a wretch addict, hardcore wretch, but the thing I'm interested in, how much did we misunderstand who he was? And how much did he change? He went from being the mayor of a small town in Western Pennsylvania to being a U.S. senator. He had a stroke. He went through a grueling rehabilitation process. A lot changed in his life. So I really am curious to get at the question of how much did we misapprehend who you were and how much have you changed over the past 2 years of your life? I think I find him just an endlessly fascinating person.
Yeah.
Make sure you tune in. Set your DVR.
Should we get to our front page here?
Mm-hmm.
Right up top, we have 2024.
And a follow-up file.
What's our follow-up file?
So, we talked before about how much is too much coverage. But what, of course, I really want to know is what are the media habits of, because are you familiar with Calvin Trillin?
Of course.
Okay. So the great Calvin Trillin, who a writer for The New Yorker for many moons, and I recommend to everyone his book of murder trial journalism called Trillin's Killins. And his premise was murder trials are fascinating because it's the only time people really have to tell the truth, right? It's not just that they're on the witness stand, but the stakes are so high. Potentially somebody's life is on the line. And everything comes out. And so trials, when I covered trials, I was fascinated by trials because they provided these windows into life beyond that criminal case. And in this case, we get a really interesting focus group about how do normal people get their news.
And the results?
This is Charlie Smart at the New York Times. The 18 New Yorkers selected to serve as jurors and alternates in the Manhattan criminal trial of former President Donald J. Trump this week were each asked the same series of 42 questions from which lawyers hoped to divine how prospective jurors might feel about the case. One key part of the questionnaire asked about the prospective jurors' media diet, having them identify which media they consume from a list of more than a dozen news organizations and social media platforms. The questionnaire also let them mention media not on the list or say they didn't follow the news. Big winner in the Matrix, New York Times, all but three of the jurors said that they got news from the New York Times. Google, getting their news from the Google.
I mean, what does that even mean? It's that, you know?
I assume what that means is that, well, to be charitable, what it means is they use the Google News function as a starting point to explore the news. Or, I'm afraid, more likely, when something happens, they go to the Googles and they say, you know, mass kangaroo escape New York City, and they get the news about that in Google News. The one juror says that they do get news from True Social. Interesting. I find that interesting. And they say they got news from True Social and no other place. that the only place that they ever got any news. Now, is this juror a person who hates Donald Trump and wanted to get on this jury so bad that they couldn't?
They might have gone a little too overplayed their hand, you know?
Well, they made the cut. They're on the jury. We've got one whose sole news source is USA Today. This is our most generic. And we've got one and only one who say that they get it from
X. And that's it.
Washington Post gets two and CNN gets two.
I like this person who said they only get their news from the Daily Mail. That's good.
That's good. This is a sophisticate.
Yeah, I like that.
Clearly a sophisticate. So there, you'll find the link to the Matrix in the show notes. And when you subscribe to our newsletter, which everyone should obviously do, and I find it fascinating. Thank you, Charlie Smart of the New York Times.
Your mention of Calvin Trillin made me try to think. I love his I don't know if memoir is the right word, but about the death of his wife, about
yes.
Alice, is beautiful. But then I was trying to think, what was the other book I read about him? I couldn't remember. And it's a very, very old book that is out of print, I believe. Or maybe not. It looks like you can order it in paperback on Amazon, called Remembering Denny, about one of his Yale classmates who was like the star of their Yale class, became a Rhodes Scholar. And it's a short book, became a Rhodes Scholar, and then became a State Department bureaucrat and committed suicide. And he goes back to try to investigate what was underneath this star person he thought they knew. And I wanted to see when it was published because it's old. And let's see. Oh, it looks like it says 2005 here, but I recommend it.
I will definitely read that. He's fabulous.
And he's an amazing writer.
He absolutely is.
Yeah, so it looks like it was reissued. Memoir of his relationship with a brilliant but tragic Yale classmate that's also a rumination on social change in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Up next, we have a political magazine piece. And it's funny, we should mention that the White House Correspondents' Dinner is this weekend. Will you be there? I will not be there.
I will not be there.
And I will also not be attending any of the parties surrounding it.
I will not be attending.
But that means that we get all these pieces about journalism and the White House's relationship with the press and all this
CNN is covering it live. They're highly promoting their coverage of.
Oh, my gosh.
You can watch it live. Watch it live. As Hollywood for Ugly People turns out its best as Washington gathers to fake laugh at a. Who do we know who the entertainer is?
Yeah. I'm forgetting it now, but. Correspondence. Let's look it up. Dinner. Comedian.
Okay. Well, Colin Jost can be quite funny. So maybe
yes,
it will be funny.
It's Colin Jost.
Maybe it will be funny. Okay.
It's
kudos.
Colin Jost and Kelly O'Donnell from NBC is the
master the peacock.
Of ceremonies.
Yeah. Peacock. Proud to be a peacock. There you
Ooh.
Go.
Okay. So in that vein, we have a big Politico piece. The petty feud between the New York Times and the White House that actually, it starts with a petty feud, but gets into a pretty revealing, I think, view of, you know, the White House's resentment of the New York Times for actually covering them.
How dare they?
And it starts with the White House being upset that a reporter who was covering an overnight shift accidentally, because he didn't understand the rules, used a White House spokesman's name instead of saying just a White House spokesman. He didn't understand what the term on background meant. So he put the guy's name in the story. And then the New York Times wasn't responsive when they were asked to remove the name. But it gets to some more interesting things. It says, and this is by Eli Stokels, the president's flacks might bemoan what they see as the entitlement of Time staffers, but they themselves put the newspaper on the highest of pedestals given its history, stature, and unparalleled reach. And yet, they see the Times falling short in a make-or-break moment for American democracy, stubbornly refusing to adjust its coverage as it strives for the appearance of impartial neutrality, often blurring the asymmetries between former President Donald Trump and Biden, when it comes to their perceived flaws and vastly different commitments to democratic principles. Biden aides largely view the election as an existential choice for the country, high stakes that they believe justify tougher tactics toward the Times and the press as a whole. Sometimes reporters have found themselves cut off by sources after publishing pieces the Bidens and top aides didn't like. Columnist Maureen Dowd, for example, complained to colleagues that she stopped hearing from White House officials after a column on Hunter Biden. For many Times veterans, such actions suggest that the Trump era has warped many Democrats' expectations of journalists. Essentially, the Biden White House thinks Trump is so bad that we should not be covered aggressively. And that has left a bad taste in their mouth when they are covered critically and aggressively, and a bad taste apparently in the mouths of the New York Times, who are on the receiving end of that attitude from the White House when they don't even cover them that aggressively. They're like, we actually like you.
The subhead, Biden's people think they're entitled. The Times says they're not being realistic. And you're 100% correct, which is, if you think this is hard, right? If you think this is hostile coverage, what are you talking about? And the idea that it would be better for Joe Biden somehow if the New York Times was a total lapdog and wrote every piece in the context of, but Donald Trump is much, much worse. If the threshold was, will this piece help Donald Trump get elected? Well, then you wouldn't do much coverage at the White House. You just wouldn't. You wouldn't do much coverage at all, because anything other than press releases might help Donald Trump win the White House. But that's not the New York Times job.
There is an interesting quote in here from Elizabeth Buemiller, who's the White House editor of the Times. And she says, they're not being realistic about what we do for a living. You can be a force for democracy, liberal democracy. You don't have to be a force for the Biden White House. And that is where they're
Say
confused.
Word, Elizabeth Buemiller. Yes. Correct.
All right. Up next, House Speaker Mike Johnson and several of his Republican colleagues visited Columbia University. They addressed the tent encampment on the lawn of the school from the steps of Columbia's Low Library. We're recording on Thursday. They were there yesterday on Wednesday. And CNBC reports that House Speaker Mike Johnson struggled to get a word in edgewise Wednesday, battling a chorus of booing crowds during a speech at Columbia University, where he condemned the ongoing student protest against Israel's bombardment of Gaza. Enjoy your free speech, Johnson said tersely, pausing his prepared remarks to wait for the jeering to die down. Columbia's campus has been frozen by controversy since student protesters set up a tent encampment April 17th to protest the war in Gaza. You know, it was interesting because I saw the Beacon had a reporter at the protests, and her videos show that it was extremely difficult to hear what Johnson was saying. However, it was a press conference and you could hear him clearly on television. But he was there with his House colleagues to call for the resignation of the Columbia president, who said she called in the police to get rid of these protesters over last weekend. Then they set up their encampment again. She said, we're giving you till midnight. Oh, then it was 8 a.m. Then it was 48 hours. And clearly what Columbia is trying to avoid here is a violent confrontation between law enforcement officers and student protesters, which is what happened in the Vietnam War protests of 1968, where hundreds of people were injured. And I just think that would go over much different today. And so she's betwixt and between here. I think she's between a rock and a hard place. And what was really interesting to me, and I'm curious in your thoughts, is that the first set of university presidents who went and testified in December,
yes,
they said the wrong things before this House panel and inflamed the nation. And they said the wrong things so that they could go back and be accepted back on campus by the far left.
They were going to speak truth
okay?
to power.
Yeah. Yes. So Manoush Shafiq, the Columbia president, she went and her testimony was pretty uneventful. Like, she went and said basically the right things in front of the panel. But as a result, she could not go back to campus. Like, these people started protesting her testimony while it was underway or the night before, because she had started suspending students and cracking down and forcing the rules. And so what strikes me really is that what we have here is not a communication problem. It's really not what these people are saying before Congress, we have problems in terms of the condition of these campuses.
Yes.
People who are on them, the faculty who staff them, because either way, you say the wrong thing, you say the right thing, like the places are ungovernable. The situation is unsustainable.
The places are ungovernable, and the backlash that is now underway against these protests and the delegitimating, it's an interesting thing in the coverage in this CNBC piece about Johnson alludes to it too, but Students for Justice for Palestine and others say they're being unfairly lumped in with the virulent anti-Semitic bigotry and not anti-war, but pro-war, right? The people who say it's time to push Israel off the map. They're being unfairly lumped in with these people and all of this stuff. And just as a note about this issue in general, and it's something I just want to keep repeating, academic freedom is really important. It's really important for institutions to be places where people can express unpopular ideas and that where professors can do unpopular research and they can, that's tenure is a good thing and academic freedom is a good thing. These students have free speech rights as Americans. The federal government cannot interfere with their ability to express themselves, but they don't have free speech rights as Columbia University students. Columbia University or any university can have a code of student conduct. It can have rules that relate to if you sign up, you sign a contract, right? When you go to one of these schools, you're signing a contract. You get a handbook. They say, here's the handbook. These are what the rules are for going here. You don't have your First Amendment rights do not enter into that relationship because if you're interfering with other people learning, if you're making other people feel unsafe, how many, by the way, kids who thought, oh, I'd really like to go to Columbia. How many Jewish kids, how many conservative or moderate kids look at this and go, oh, well, not Columbia. I'm not going to go to Columbia because after they said you must disperse, they said, well, what we meant was that
we'll negotiate with you for 48 more hours.
We'll keep talking about it. We'll blah, 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 blah. And it does not make for a safe, worthwhile learning environment. And this is just...
They've shut down school.
They've shut
down school. Their classes are online for the rest of the year. And so you have, and we're going to get to a piece about this, kids whose first year of college was COVID are now back online at the end of their school year because of these protests. And I have no confidence that these kids will attend a graduation that is not ruined by
disruptive
protests.
Well, let's do it now. We can come back to this other piece. This is a Wall Street Journal piece. They entered college in isolation and leave in protest, the class that missed out on fun. Very good piece in the Journal.
Yeah. The Journal writes about these people, including Columbia students, and says a student, Tejasri Vijayakumar, I'm sure I'm butchering that. She says, we've never had a calm time where we can just focus on being kids. She's a senior and student body president of Columbia College at Columbia University. You talk to people in generations above us about college, and they said you could just gather in spaces and do whatever you want and no one would stop you. That's not really true anymore. When they do show up to class, they're less prepared and less willing to engage in discussions, faculty say. The share of students saying they're disabled, for example, by anxiety or learning issues climbed roughly 23% between 2019 and 2021, the most recent year available, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of Education Department data. And bringing it back to Mike Johnson, one of the things he said yesterday was, go back to class and stop wasting your parents' money.
Yeah.
And it does make you wonder, like, what do the parents of these kids think? They are paying like about $90,000 a year for their kids to camp out in tents on the lawn. Ilhan Omar obviously approves of what her daughter's doing. But I mean, my parents would not have approved of my.
No, no.
They would not have been cool with that.
Well, if I was protesting for a flat tax, maybe my dad would have been cool. But I doubt even then. The quote.
I don't think so. They would have been like, get back to class.
That's what do. And this is true for the universities, and it's true for the students at the universities. Be what you're supposed to be. Do the thing that you're supposed to do. But I do quibble with this quote from Nathan Thomas, Vice President of Student Affairs at Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. We may never be back to a more engaged time just because of how generations learn from each other. This may be the new normal. There may be no real return to the past. I say to you, Vice President Thomas, I expect that the next generation of young people, the people who are going to be entering college, people who are my eldest man, of the cohort of my eldest man child, who are going to be juniors and seniors in high school, I suspect that they will want a very different experience than these experiences. And I suspect that the Xennials, am I using that correctly? Okay. I suspect that the people who are now in their late teens look at a world riven by safetyism, political conflict, protest, goofball, political correctness, all of this stuff, and they're going to want something different. And I think they're going to be a lot more chill. And the generations do learn from one another. And I think what they're learning is that they want to be more mature, more able to be alive in the world. And their parents are learning too, right? The parents of kids who are coming along after these kids have been treated to books like The Coddling of the American Mind. They have watched all of this take place. They want something different, and they're going to vote with their feet, and they're going to send their kids to schools that don't descend into barbarism, where there is an actual environment of learning and free inquiry and not screaming at people about blood libel as they're trying to walk across the quad. Harumph. But the Mike Johnson files, this is a strange new respect alert. Mike Johnson, who was, I still believe, might possibly have been generated by AI. The name is too fake. The hair is too perfect. But Mike Johnson, after going to Mar-a-Lago and telling Donald Trump, yeah, if we need to try to steal the election again in 2024, I'm going to be around. I'm open. So he gave Trump what he wanted, talked about millions of Biden flooding the country, blah, 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 and pre-cast out on the election returns. But that got him from Trump cover to move this big foreign aid bill. And so the strange new respect started pouring forth, and the Atlantic, Eliana Plott at the Atlantic, was ready, and she must have been working on this speech. I'm sorry, Eliana Plott. Elena Plott Calabro wrote this, must have been working on this piece for some time, because it goes back to when the Republicans had their retreat, which I think was in early March, but had their retreat at the Greenbrier. So she'd been working on this for a period of time and timed it impeccably to come out right at the moment where Mike Johnson went from boogeyman of the religious right person that we talked on this podcast, the coverage that whatever anybody thinks of Mike Johnson.
He's a freak who tries to marry his daughter.
Right, exactly. The early coverage on Mike Johnson was daughter marrying freak. And now, strange
Christian
new
respect. Christian nationalist.
Yep. And now, strange new respect. And he, I don't, this goes back to the John Fetterman point. How wrong were they? How much has Mike Johnson been changed by having a different kind of job? Here's how Plott, what's the married name? I'm sorry, I'm going to have to learn it. Plott Calabro describes it. Johnson would quickly learn that not even his own hardline brand of conservatism, a record in lockstep with the Republican base on issues from abortion to Donald Trump's border wall, could insulate him from the far-right charges of betrayal. In the past 6 months, he has seen his closest ideological allies become his most outspoken opponents, their belligerence manifesting in ceaseless churn of failed procedural votes, public denunciations, and of his leadership, and now the threat of his removal. So in talking to Democrats, I learned something interesting about Mike Johnson. The caricature of Mike Johnson that is sort of reflected here, the caricature of Mike Johnson, they say not true, right? In talking to mainstream thoughtful Democrats, they all had praise for Mike Johnson as a person who sincerely wanted to do a good job. And whether he will be able to do the good job or whether he'll do whatever, the strange, just I'm noting for the future, I'm lighting the lamp here. The strange new respect lamp is lit. And the question is, will that kill Mike Johnson? Because one of the things that was smart about him going to Columbia, you got to not enjoy the strange new respect. When you get some strange new respect in politics, the secret is don't go roll around in it, right? You don't run over there and say like, yes, I'm glad you all love me now. You have to check them back up and say, wait, don't forget you hate me. Don't forget that you hate me. And otherwise, the long way of saying there is a very low number of flattering profile pieces on a Republican Speaker of the House that will not cause harm to somebody's desire to be the Speaker, right? You don't want every day for you. He does not want a 60 Minutes piece to air this weekend that says, Mike Johnson, the Democrats Republican. We really like this guy. That's not helpful to Mike Johnson. So it was savvy of him to go to Columbia and get exactly what he knew would happen, which is hostile questioning and booed by the crowd.
You know, it was not savvy.
Not savvy. Less savvy.
Brooke Baldwin's decision to write this piece in Vanity Fair. She writes a first-person essay. The headline is, Leaving CNN Was How I Found My Voice. And she was an anchor on CNN for many years. The subheadline is, Former anchor Brooke Baldwin exited the network after 13 years, not because of Trump coverage or pandemic chaos, but because of something far more ordinary and insidious. I will admit to not having actually figured out why did she leave?
It's the silencing of women.
Okay.
It's gender. It's gender archetypes. 'Cause CNN has got no women. Women can't succeed at CNN. It's very hard on women at CNN. My general complaint about the piece is life is hard. Don't go looking for sympathy. You had this easy, delightful job that you've had, and crafting this victim narrative for yourself is not super. But my specific complaint about this, I worked for the same media company in West Virginia as Brooke Baldwin when she was the prime anchor. She was the number one anchor. She was the highest paid person. She was it. And she says here, I want to quote it exactly.
Oh.
So here, she's talking about her.
It's basically all about how terrible Jeff Zucker is.
Why didn't I leave earlier? She asks.
Because you were making a lot of money.
For one thing, that little girl deep inside of me would have been disappointed. She and I, we lived in small town West Virginia. We dated the wrong guys. We put off having kids. The hustling. We can't quit now. We worked too hard for this. This was our dream. I'm sorry. Was being the number one anchor at WOWK television, the suffering that you endured for this career, was it that bad to have everybody kissing your patootie and people turning on your whims to go around? The uncoolness of being dismissive or treating a good opportunity that you had as something that you had to suffer through to get where you are. Come on. Like, be cool. You had a good opportunity. You were well compensated. You were famous in the, you know, you were the judge at the celebrity chili cook-off or whatever the things that you did. Just be cool. You're not a victim. You were not victimized because you anchored the 6 o'clock news or the 5 o'clock news on WOWK Charleston Huntington. Get over it. Harumph. I'm very harumphy today.
And then she says, my lawyer and publicist worked hard to negotiate my exit, fighting to allow me to announce my own news on my own show. In February, I got to do exactly that. Through my final days at CNN, I was so allergic to the idea of that man that instead of risking running into him on the way to the bathroom, I contemplated peeing in a Gatorade bottle in my office.
Whoa.
That's about Jeff Zucker. Everything was upside down. On my last day at the network, after I said my goodbyes, I slipped out the literal side door of the building and of my dream. On my way out, the only CNN face I saw was a security guard's, masked, hands trembling. Anthony stood there clutching a shoebox. He'd bought me a pair of Air Jordans as a goodbye. I hugged him and wept.
Oh,
no
gosh.
Cheesy plaque, no champagne, no send-off party, just quiet. Life is unfair. People are shitty. Bosses are bullies. This is not news. In the hierarchy of giving a shit, I didn't think my story, my thousand little cuts, amounted to much. But now she realized it actually merits a long essay in
yes,
Vanity Fair.
She realized it didn't matter much except for this 2,000-word journey to the center of oneself
Okay.
Yeah, that we'll put that back for the West Virginia that she abjures. The West Virginia response to this is, I don't know that I'd have told that one.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Up next, Chris, you flagged this piece, My
baby.
Dinner with Mark Andreessen.
Oh, baby. Okay. You're familiar with the work of Rick Perlstein,
I'm
right?
I'm familiar with his work.
Okay. So Rick Perlstein.
I like one of his books.
The Goldwater one?
Yeah.
Okay. So Rick Perlstein, who made a career out of writing from the left about conservatism. And his first book about Barry Goldwater, which the name of which escapes me right now, did win plaudits from some Republicans. I was not as big of a fan, and that's probably because I like Barry Goldwater too much. So I'm probably more sensitive about Barry Goldwater than other people are. I think Barry Goldwater was a baller, and I think it's super cool. And my obsession with what America would, how different America would have been if Bobby Kennedy or Jack Kennedy had not been shot is not so much rooted in what the Kennedys would have done, but what the 1964 presidential election would have been like as a contest between Jack Kennedy and Barry Goldwater. Because that would have been a really good election for America to have. But anyway, Before the Storm, and basically it's about how Barry Goldwater was part of the unraveling of American political consensus, of course, forgetting that the political consensus that they were talking about had only existed since the Second World War. And so it was the 20-year political consensus. Anyway, harumph. Perlstein then goes on and writes a book about Ronald Reagan. He writes about Richard Nixon, and this is his jam. As a result of writing these books, he has gotten to know a lot of rich, famous, and important people. And now, he says that he is ready to tell all. He is ready. My dinner with Andreessen, billionaires I have known, he says, part one of a three-part series. And here he's talking about Andreessen was Netscape?
I don't remember the company, but he's now like runs the preeminent venture capital firm out in Silicon Valley, Andreessen Horowitz.
Sure.
And it's like H16Z.
He rich. He's very rich.
Very rich.
And it was Netscape. Colin on our fact check desk confirms that it was Netscape, but he was an early Silicon Valley entrepreneur, got very rich, got richer doing all this stuff. And Perlstein was invited to a book club at Andreessen's house to talk about. So this is, have you ever been in a book club?
Not really.
So if you have a book club, you're liable to talk about books. If you are a multi-billionaire, when your book club is reading a book, what do? You fly the author in a private jet out to your book club and do all this stuff.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That would be like the best book club ever.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't like it because then you got to talk to them and like, you're like, oh, that's interesting because I would hate.
You would not like that?
I would not like that because.
You don't have to talk to them. You would have like a staff that could.
No.
Deal
what
with
I
them.
Mean is that if I didn't like the book, I would have to talk to them.
Oh, well, then
them.
You wouldn't fly the author in.
But I'm saying if I was in the book club, if
you. Oh, I see what
you're
saying.
You were a multi-billionaire and you said, we're having the author of this book come in and I didn't like the book, I don't want to talk to him because I don't want to say, I'd actually like to raise a few quibbles with your book because I hate that. And so I'm anti, but I'm anti so many things that involve forced social interaction. But anyway, the Perlstein decides, and he's writing for the American Prospect, or maybe it's not even the American Prospect anymore. It's just the Prospect because...
It's the American Prospect.
Okay. I didn't know whether they were being more international now. But he writes this piece where he tells all about what was said and how these people are in part of an effort to hold billionaires to account. And he takes a quote that he even acknowledges. So he says, and here's what the man in the castle with the seven fireplaces said it. I'm glad there's OxyContin in video games to keep those people quiet. Here's what Perlstein says. I'm taking the liberty of putting it in quotation marks.
Oh.
Though I can't be sure those were his exact words. Mark, if you're reading, feel free to get in touch and refresh my memory. Maybe he said quiescent or docile or maybe even powerless. Yeah, maybe he said that. Maybe Rick Perlstein, he said, I want to keep these people powerless. Something certainly along those lines. He was joking, sort of, but he was serious, definitely. Kidding on the square jokes like those are called. All that talk about human potential and morality, and this man afire to reorder life as we know it, jokingly welcomes chemical enslavement of those he grew up with for the sin of not being as clever and ambitious as he. There is something very, very wrong with us that our society affords so much power to people like this. What? I'm sorry, what? You flew on the jet. When you got on the jet, the private jet, to fly out to this person's house, you knew what you were doing. And do you know why you were doing it? Because you wanted to sell more books and you wanted to be more influential, which is fine, which is just fine that Rick Perlstein wanted to sell more books and be more influential.
Presumably you were paid to,
even
got
if
a paycheck to attend the book club too.
And even if you weren't, right? Even if it was just access, you wanted the access. And now, a decade later, you come out and say, I must tell all these people, these rich people, in a shocking revelation, are super rich. Further shocking revelation, they, and I don't know whether they'd had a few glasses of wine or whatever, made a joke that I find distasteful. And now I will, acknowledging that I don't really know whether it's a quote, put it in quotes and use this as an indictment of the whole system. This is, I don't know what to call it, but it ain't journalism.
He also says, I knew from The New Yorker that Andreessen had grown up in an impoverished agricultural small town in Wisconsin and despised it, as opposed to really loving growing up in an impoverished agricultural small town. But I certainly was not prepared for his vituperation on the subject. He made it clear that people who chose not to leave such places deserved whatever impoverishment, cultural and political neglect and alienation they suffered. And it's interesting, like, having... when you talk to people, I think, who grew up poor, people have two reactions. The first is like, nothing scares me. I could do anything. I could go back to that. I've been through it. And the other is this reaction that's like, never again,
right.
Never again, never again. But like, I do think it's sort of gross to pass judgment on somebody who grew up impoverished. And
you took the
what
flight.
Their reaction is.
And
to,
also,
to that.
You took the flight. You went. You wanted in. You don't get to later on say, oh, now that I think about it, I'm going to expose these people. Now, if what you were exposing them for was that they were part of a satanic sex murder cult and you are only now can tell the truth. But if what you have to say is, I didn't really like them and they were really rich and now I'm going to betray the thing that I did so that I can write this piece, is lame.
All right. Up next, Gateway Pundit. Conspiracy blog declares bankruptcy after suit from election workers.
How is this not a sustainable business? How is the Gateway Pundit not a sustainable business model? I for one am shocked.
And Jim Hoft, publisher of the Gateway Pundit, published a message on the website that read, TGP Communications, apparently it's the Gateway Pundit, the parent company of the Gateway Pundit, recently made the decision to seek protection under Chapter 11 of the United States Bankruptcy Code. In the Southern District of Florida, as a result of the progressive liberal lawfare attacks against our media outlet. Georgia election workers Ruby Freeman and her daughter Shay Moss sued the Gateway Pundit in December of 2021, alleging that Jim and Joe Hoff, twin brothers, engaged in a campaign of lies that instigated a deluge of intimidation, harassment, and threats that has forced them to change their phone numbers, delete their online accounts, and fear for their physical safety. In January of 2020, the site had 1.7 million unique readers going into the election year. The number dropped this year by about half. And Hoff's statement said, this is not an admission of fault or culpability. This is a common tool for reorganization and to consolidate litigation when attacks are coming from all sides. It allows TGP to consolidate this lawfare in one court for ultimate resolution. These two election workers also sued Rudy Giuliani for defamation after he accused them of working to steal the 2020 election. And Giuliani was ordered to pay them $148 million in damages. So,
and by the way, well, this is episode 1 million in. What work, what may or may not work for Donald Trump will not work for others. And Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani, now indicted in Arizona, and the Gateway pundit. Now, the idea, the debate, as we record this, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments on whether Donald Trump has presidential immunity to protect him from criminal charges from his time as president. This does not extend to chiefs of staff, lawyers at the Four Seasons Landscaping press conference, or the Gateway pundit.
Chris, that brings us to our obsessions of the week. Where we break down the stories we can't get out of our heads. And I have to say, I was amused to see a CNN story. After rocky start, Kamala Harris emerges as the Biden campaign's lead prosecutor on top issues. And this is by Edward Isaac Dover.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a paragraph in it that says, "The vice president is clearly feeling energized these days. She's more engaged. She's looser. Aides say she was the one who pushed to explicitly call out former President Donald Trump as responsible for every rollback in abortion rights. And she's clearly feeding on the old prosecutorial rush of tearing apart the opposition's argument." Anyhow, the article goes on. It's like Kamala has found her stride.
She's found her voice.
She really has. So it made me search
just
the phrase Kamala Harris has found her voice, found her stride. So the first result is that comes up. I just put CNN, Kamala finds her voice. And the first result I get, Kamala Harris found her voice on abortion rights, June 24th, 2023. The battle over abortion rights helps Kamala Harris find her voice as vice president. That's August 2nd, 2022. And then the one from 4 days ago, after rocky start, Kamala Harris emerges as the Biden's campaign's lead prosecutor on top issues, and it's about abortion, helping her find her voice. Here's another CNN piece. Kamala Harris takes center stage in Biden reelection campaign's rapid response to GOP. And so those are just the CNN stories, but there are others. We have the LA Times, how Kamala Harris found her groove.
She found a voice. She found a groove.
Yeah, she's finding so much. And my obsession is just the media wish casting around Kamala Harris being an amazing vice president and their inability to will this wish into existence.
Mwah. Perfect.
Would that it were true.
Would that it were true. All right. My obsession was triggered by our friend Eli Lake, who wrote a piece about Tucker Carlson for the Free Press. And this is not about Tucker Carlson, and it's not even really about... Eli was on our friend Jonah Goldberg's podcast, The Remnant, and listening to it, I felt real compassion for Eli. For he does... This piece is a mea culpa in a way. He says, I got sucked in to Tucker Carlson in 2020 and then watched in horror as Tucker Carlson migrated deeper into anti-Semitic adjacency, anti-Israel, pro-Russia, as all of the unraveling happened. And Eli, the best thing that you can do often when you're trying to write a persuasive piece is to begin with your own fault, right? To not say, I've been right all along and let me tell you why. But Eli says, I got mixed up. And he alludes to it in the piece, but said it more specifically in the Remnant episode. But basically that he was, well, here's from the piece. He's talking about the summer of 2020. Back then, it seemed like nearly everything we were told by the mainstream liberal outlets was a half-truth or a lie. When the New York Post disclosed email Hunter Biden laptop, we were told that Twitter and Facebook did not shadow ban conservatives. Experts and journalists insisted that the high schools never taught critical race theory. And yet Hunter Biden's laptop was real. Social media really was shadow banning conservatives. Our high schools really were teaching hard left theories of race and gender. And Tucker reported these stories fearlessly, despite the gaslighting from his cable TV news peers. And it got me thinking about this. This is not a binary choice. how you get your news is not a binary choice. You do not need to choose between Coke and Pepsi. You do not need to choose between brand X and brand Y. That's not, there are many deficiencies and many problems that arise from a splintered, atomized media landscape. There are many. And audience capture, and I wrote a whole book about it, and it's certainly true. But as Joe Biden would say, take the win. There are upsides, and the upsides are you don't have to choose between Coke and Pepsi. You don't have to say, do I want this dumb, bad thing or that slightly less bad, dumb thing? I understand that's how our political parties work. I understand the power of negative partisanship in politics, but you don't have to choose between Tucker Carlson and Don Lemon. You can choose neither. You can say, I don't think I'll do any of that. You can watch something else. You can stream, as I've said before, and I'll say again, the complete catalog of the TV show Benson is available on on Amazon. You can watch the whole thing. Jessica and I are finishing up the eighth season. It's taken us almost 5 years, but we're finishing up the eighth season of Magnum PI. Treat yourself. Watch something other than that. Watch something other than that. Don't get your news from places that are at war with each other. If an outlet is defined by its opposition to or support of a political viewpoint, maybe find a better neighborhood to hang out in. And the only quibble I have with Eli's piece is, and it's as everything Eli does, well researched. He brings all the receipts. He's very good at that stuff. Is it could have been avoided. The trap, he could have slipped the trap if only he had said, I don't need to choose between Coke and Pepsi. I can have a delicious cream soda.
All right. That brings us to my favorite time of the week, which is reader mail.
And oh,
Chris,
my gosh. Look
we
at
have
this.
A note from Sheila McCarthy who says, hi, Eliana. I have wanted to chime in for a long time after having heard your many conversations with Chris about fashion. I knew Chris when he was 13 years old, and even then, he was a fashion plate. The school where I taught and which he attended frequently had dress-up days. The way our headmistress asked the students to dress on those days was, in her words, like you were going out to eat with your grandmother. Some boys especially struggled to understand that this meant a little more than a clean shirt and new sneakers. For Chris, on the other hand, dress-up days meant nothing less than a blue blazer, colorful corduroys, and a bow tie. I guess
Baller.
It's true that the boy is father to the man. Thanks, and great show. Love it.
Miss McCarthy was such an important part of my growing up. I love to see this from her. She was such an important part of my growing up because, as you'll struggle to believe, I was a weird kid. I was a weird kid, and I was interested in weird stuff that most kids my age were not interested in. And
boy, I really can't see that in your children at all.
I know. It's a total, it's just out of left field. But I was this intellectually curious, dorky kid. And Sheila McCarthy, who taught Latin at the Whitfield School, took me under her wing. She took me in and gave me a place to be weird and explore this stuff. And she's funny and charming and delightful and just a great all-around person. But there is one fact check. I did not wear the bow tie until ninth grade because I remember when I acquired my first bow tie, or no, at the end of ninth grade, I remember acquiring the bow tie. I remember the Brooks Brothers where I purchased the bow tie with my own money. And I remember the first time I wore it, which was at a commencement ceremony that marked the end of my time at the Whitfield School. So it was, the bow tie did not become part of, but I do cop to, and I am wearing a blue blazer right now, even as we speak. And I'm sure I did have colorful corduroys, which will be the name of my memoir.
Okay, next up. We have a note from Eli Sack in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and he says, hi, El Rechos. I was served up this great article from Esquire that I thought I would pass along about the workhorse that is the Wrangler cowboy cut jean. It could be a contender for a more casual style section. I thought the writing was fun and the fashion argument to be compelling. It's truly a pair of trousers that won't make you look like a pig on stilts, as Chris might say. I'm a lifelong Levi's man, so unfortunately it's news I can't use, but the advice seems sound nonetheless. Okay, and the article from Esquire is every man on earth should be wearing Wrangler cowboy cut jeans.
No.
Durable, flattering, and selling for only $30. Name a better buy.
No. They may be great. And I don't know, Mr. Sack, how old a man you are. And if you're a younger man, I wish you well with all of this. But just I want to say it again. Unless you're doing physical work, if you're busting a bronco, if you are roping steers, if you are putting in fence line, wear your blue jeans. Do it. But for men over 35, is it there? It's younger. I guess I would say this, Mr. Sack. It's younger than you think. The age is younger than you think at which you should stop wearing blue jeans for doing anything but outdoor labor or the just, Mr. Sack, hear me. The word that you should use, you shouldn't say jeans. Say the word dungarees. Say the word dungarees. Internalize the word dungarees. These are work pants, and if you want to wear them to do work, that's great. And if you're young and cool, wear tight jeans. Wear any jeans you want. But Mr. Sack, ask yourself, am I too old to wear jeans for casual attire out in public? And look, take a hard look.
Chris, that brings us to your favorite time of the week.
Oh.
Where I am forced to say something nice. But please, please, you first.
This is a beaut. I love it. This is from Channel 19 in Cleveland. And it is Ohio company launches Thermonator, a flame-throwing robot dog. I, of course, was captivated by this instantly. Here's your lead. Throw Flame. These guys really went reaching for a name, right? We make flamethrowers. What do you want to call it? Throw Flame. An Ohio-based flamethrower manufacturer, also 10 out of 10, has released what it says is the first ever robot dog with a flamethrower attached for remote fire starting. The Thermonator is a robotic quadruped with the company's ARC flamethrower mounted on its back. The robot dog features IDAR mapping, first-person view navigation, obstacle avoidance, and laser sighting to remotely deliver fire with a 30-foot-long firing range and a one-hour battery life. The company says the flamethrowing platform can be used for wildfire management, prescribed agricultural burns, snow and ice removal, or even entertainment special effects. And I just want to say to all you hippies out there who say that America is not great anymore, for all of you people who are down on the United States of America, I say this. Who's leading the world in robot flame-throwing dog technology? Is it China? I don't think so. Is it the European Union? No. Who other than Clevelanders are figuring out ways to deliver a 30-foot jet of flame anywhere, anytime? That's the Thermonator.
All right, Chris, my favorite, just because the headline really cracked me up, was the New York Times article. Beyonce showed her hair being washed. Here's why it matters.
News you can use. It's like Axios.
In a video on Instagram, the singer provided fans a rare glimpse of her routine. And the article is about how she's got this new line of hair care products out. And she wears extensions and wigs all the time. And so it was this revelatory thing to see her actual hair. But the headline, I couldn't get past that. It was really great.
Hair so long that it looks like weave.
And then
now she cut it all off.
Yeah,
now she looks like Eve.
What happened? Early Monday morning, a video was posted on Beyonce's Instagram featuring a close-up of the star's long, curly hair being washed, conditioned, straightened, and styled using Sacred products. That's her line.
Sacred?
Yes, sacred, like Beyonce.
Oh, boy.
In the video, she said that she was finally ready to show how it has helped her hair. Blah, blah, blah. Very amusing. Anyhow, that is all the time we have for the news about the news. If you have a story you want us to talk about, email us at wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com and sign up for our newsletter at nebulouspodcasts.com. This has been Ink-Stained Wretches from Nebulous Media, produced by Colin Ciccola. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Wretches.